Of the Wisconsin voters surveyed, 86% say it was appropriate to close schools and businesses and restrict gatherings to protect public health as the new coronavirus spreads. It's just one of the findings from the latest poll out of the Marquette Law School. The poll includes opinion questions. It also sheds light on the hardships people are experiencing due to COVID-19, especially when it comes to work. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and there's room for you in our conversation. What questions do you have about the poll and its results? What are your thoughts about social distancing policies that have been enacted in Wisconsin? And how are you experiencing maybe a financial pinch because of the coronavirus? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He's also a professor of law and public policy, and he's ready to break down the numbers and help us understand what the latest poll can and can't tell us. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be here.
What do we know about public support for the state's actions to stop the spread of the disease compared to the federal response? We know that 86% say it was appropriate to close things, but what are some of the other numbers that you were able to get from your survey?
That's right. And I thought it was also striking. Only 10% then said that they thought we had overreacted and it was going to be worse than the disease. So that's very lopsided. We found strong support for the federal law that was passed to send cash payments directly to adults around the country. 51% strongly supported that, and another 28% somewhat approved of it. So that's 79% support for that federal action. Here in the state, Governor Evers' actions with respect to the epidemic, garner, I guess is the word I'm looking for, 76% approval, kind of an unheard of number. 17% say they disapprove, and that's pretty bipartisan. 66% of Republicans, two-thirds of Republicans, approve of the measures Evers has taken. In contrast, President Trump receives 51% approval for his handling of the epidemic. That's 3 points higher than his overall job approval, but it's not as big as the bump in approval we had seen for him in some national surveys a couple of weeks ago.
And with the folks that say they disapprove of the governor's response, do we know what reasons they cite for saying it's not appropriate?
No, we don't follow up on that. A few of them are part of that 10% that overall say they think it's an overreaction. And so I'm sure that a good chunk of the 17 that disapprove come out of that group. But others, I do not know what their reasons are because we didn't follow up and say, ask why.
And is that true, too, then, for the folks that responded to the question that led to your number four, Trump's approval rating?
I think there are two things with that. One of the differences between Trump and Evers' approval is that Trump's approval is much more divided on party lines, the same way we've seen massive party polarization over President Trump in his overall job approval throughout his term in office. There's plenty of polarization in Wisconsin, but in the case of Evers, you see a lot of the other party coming over to support his behavior. In Trump's case, though, there's only a very small increment of Democrats that approve of the job he's doing on coronavirus who don't approve of him overall. So there's been much less cross-party movement with Trump than there has been with Evers.
Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson joined us on The Morning Show last Wednesday and said he supported Governor Evers' decision to shut down non-essential businesses to stop the spread of the virus.
So what we need to do is really focus on the non-essential businesses. where people gather, where there's a real risk of spreading the coronavirus. Other businesses have to remain open. We obviously need hospitals to remain open. That means all the businesses that supply and service hospitals have to stay open.
Yeah, so it sounds like, although not one of your folks polled, that Ron Johnson is one of those Republicans who's saying, you know what, some of this move by this Democratic governor makes a lot of sense here.
I'm sorry, I did not hear the segment with Senator Johnson. I think there's a balance here between the shutdowns, the stay at home, the closing of schools and businesses, and the economic impact that those are having. We are seeing a big economic impact on people already. And moving forward, we're going to go through the next month at least, if not much longer, with rising illness from the epidemic, but also a flood of new unemployment and reduced employment. And that, as sort of the senator was alluding to, is going to hit small businesses that aren't in essential sectors especially hard. So right now, as I've said, there's overwhelming support for the kinds of shutdowns that we're doing. But the pressure in the coming weeks will be very high to balance controlling the spread of the epidemic and the toll that that takes on the public. But at the same time, how effective is the response to support citizens when they are going through extreme economic difficulties? We've seen unemployment insurance claims, I don't even know what the right word is, explode?
Right, yeah, the system is overwhelmed, they've told us.
Exactly, you need a big adjective for that. And so these are going to be two competing pressures in the society in the coming weeks, and how we deal with it, and then eventually how do we deal with the economic recovery after all of this, I think will keep both the state and federal officials occupied for a long time.
And what numbers do you have from this poll with how voters view the performance of the economy?
Well, there's more optimism than you might expect, given the first week of unemployment numbers or claims. There's a very notable increase in the number of people that think the economy has gotten worse over the last year, and an increase in the number that think it will be worse a year from now. But that's coupled with a little rise in positive views, especially for the future, that a year from now things will be better. At this moment, when we're right at the front edge of the most sudden economic recession in history, the question is, are people saying of the next 12 months, wow, it's terrible right now, but in a year it'll be better? That would make a lot of sense. Likewise, if you look over the whole of the past year, maybe you say the economy really did get better over the last year, but you're discounting how bad it is right now.
Sure,
I think we're too early to know.
We're talking with pollster Charles Franklin, who stays with us here on the Ideas Network, as we delve into more numbers from the latest Marquette poll that came out just this week. Your thoughts, your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the poll or its results? What do you want to weigh in on? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina, and this conversation continues here on The Morning Show. People in Wisconsin say the new coronavirus pandemic is changing the way they live. 57% of the people who responded to the new Marquette University poll say their life has been disrupted a lot. Just 3% say changes to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19 have not been a disruption. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're working through the numbers out from the Wisconsin-based survey that covers politics, policy, current events, health, and the economy. And there's room for you in this discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you think our government leaders are taking the right course of action right now? How has that affected your life, your work, your family? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, and we are breaking down the numbers together. And now Steve from Sun Prairie is ready to talk with us. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I guess I have a comment and a question. I'm one of the people who don't actually support what Evers is doing. And the reason why is I think there should be more balance, you know, providing more of a quarantine for people that are at risk than people that are not at risk. So that's my comment. And my question has to do with, if you look at the disparity in approval of Evers versus Trump, I just want to know how much the guest attributes that to the known factor of Trump derangement syndrome, where no matter what Trump does, it's automatically wrong.
All right. Thanks, Steve. So Charles Franklin, Steve is saying some people aren't going to like the president, even if he does good things. Is that something that is able to be reflected in your poll?
Yeah, it is. And that's the party polarization I was talking about earlier, with overall Trump approval, fewer than 10% of Democrats approve of the president. In terms of his handling of the coronavirus among Democrats, that goes up to about 12 or 13%. So it's slightly higher among those Democrats, but still enormously negative. Of course, there's a flip side. Republican support has been in the high 80s to low 90s. And also doesn't move very much, no matter what. So this is the polarization that makes it hard for the president to benefit from positive things, but also makes it hard for him to fall very much. Neither side really changes their views. Whereas with the governor, it's a much more fluid situation across parties. And I think the other point Steve made about how you balance the layoffs and the quarantines and so on, that's something that I think in retrospect we will see a lot of discussion about what the best way to respond is. Right now, the epidemic models certainly suggest this extreme social distancing, but there's clearly coming with a big economic cost.
And that's something that's actually reflected in this latest poll. I mean, what are people saying about the economic effect of this coronavirus outbreak looking like on their lives?
It's already present. 9% say they've lost a job. More say someone else in the family has lost a job. 22% have had their work hours reduced. And about 26% say they're now working from home. So in all of those, there's been change. You also mentioned at the top of the segment the over 50% that said this had had a major impact on their lives. But not surprisingly, you find that those who have children living at home, it's had a bigger impact on them. And especially for women with children at home, it's had a bigger impact. So there's a little bit of big impact for everyone. But if you have children at home and you're a woman, it's had an especially large impact.
And does the poll help us learn why some of the respondents are concerned about the pandemic? Does it lay that out for us?
Yes. We're seeing unusually high levels of following the news about the epidemic. Over 76% say they're following it very closely. Only 1% say they're not following it at all.
Wow.
68% are very concerned about the epidemic. Again, just 2% not at all concerned. There's some drop off in worry about the impact of the virus on you personally. We asked, considering both the chance that you get it and how serious it might be, how worried are you? 30% are very worried about getting it, and another 40% somewhat worried. But there are 29% who are either not very worried or not at all worried. So in that, there's a little bit of a backing away from worry at the low end that doesn't correspond to the enormous attention and concern about it, but still put together a solid 71% who are either very or somewhat worried about it.
We're talking with Charles Franklin, who is the director of Marquette University's Law School poll, about the latest findings. Still time for your question at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the poll or the findings? You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Charles, with the coronavirus pandemic looming, decisions about the Democratic National Convention are admittedly up in the air. What does the poll say about where voters in the state lean in terms of support for the Democratic presidential primary? Because that continues. We're moving forward with the elections.
That's right. Well, in moving ahead with the April primary, 51% think the date should be moved, but 44% say it should be held as scheduled. So a kind of even split there. And on this one, there are very small partisan differences, but we do see a large difference that Black and Hispanic voters are much more anxious to move the election. We also see more concern for moving it in urban areas of the state and less concern in the more rural parts of the state.
Do we have any context for that?
Well, I mean, the outbreak in Milwaukee is especially concentrated in the African-American part of the city. African-Americans have been disproportionately hit by the virus there. So I don't know that this response is directly tied to that, but it certainly fits with the experience of Black people in Milwaukee who have suffered much worse consequences from the virus than the other parts of the state.
And speaking specifically to candidates for president, what do we know from this poll and the last one, how they kind of compare, maybe changed or not, when it comes to Biden versus Sanders in the Democratic primary?
Well, we've seen a real shift in the presidential primary. Our last poll in February was taken before South Carolina's primary and before the Super Tuesday victories that really catapulted Joe Biden into a front runner status. A month ago, Biden had just 15% support to Sanders 29, but this month it's 62 for Biden, 34 for Sanders, a major shift in support. And that reflects the consolidation as so many other candidates dropped out and as the party has rallied around Biden. I will say that people, given the uncertainties about voting and absentee votes and election day for next Tuesday, people should be extra cautious about this number. It's what public opinion is, but we're not sure about voter turnout, who will actually be able to get to the polls or actually be able to return their absentee ballots.
And Charles, that really brings up the idea of polling and how it is a snapshot in time. Remind us how we should think about all of the different numbers we've talked about here in this conversation.
Sure. Well, we interviewed 813 people last Tuesday to Sunday. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 4.2%. And for public opinion, that plus or minus 4.2 is a pretty good estimate of how uncertain we should be about all these numbers. When we're trying to project to an election next Tuesday, under all the conditions of uncertainty about turnout and absentee ballots, I think there it's just prudent to be more cautious than we normally would to say we're really not sure what the final turnout will be and who will make it to the polls and who will not.
And when then will we hear from about the Marquette poll the next time? When's the next time you're going to be checking in with people?
Well, we're doing polling roughly once a month, so we haven't quite set the final date for the next poll, but we'll definitely be checking in, certainly in the middle of this. We are able to call through a distributed call center, so we don't put people at risk to make the phone calls. So we're able to continue our polling as we have in the past.
All right. We'll make sure to check up on those numbers. Charles, thank you so much for breaking down the results for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He's also a professor of law and public policy. And you can find a link to the complete poll results on our program page. Just visit WPR.org/mornings. Up next here on the morning show is news. Then we're going to take a look at the state of broadband as Wisconsinites transfer their work and their schooling and even their health care online. And you're an important part of this conversation. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. What is your internet situation? Do you have access to a reliable connection? What issues have you run into? Maybe you've had to park in the library parking lot to connect online. Tell us about it. Help us understand what it looks like in your part of Wisconsin. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. We'll get into that conversation just ahead. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's the morning show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. A lack of access to quality, high-speed internet in rural Wisconsin makes online education, remote healthcare, and working from home more difficult. That's the finding in a Wisconsin Watch piece that examines our connectivity issues during this new coronavirus outbreak. Here on The Morning Show, we're talking about it with the journalist who wrote it. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we want to know how you're using the internet right now. Call 800-642-1234. Have you had to transfer your work or schooling to home? Has internet lack of access or strength problems been a barrier? What are you doing to manage it? And is your internet connection even able to withstand the increased use as your kids are trying to complete their schoolwork from home while you're on conference calls? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can email us ideas@WPR.org. Peter Cameron is an investigative journalist and the managing editor of the Badger Project. That's a nonpartisan journalism nonprofit covering Wisconsin state government and politics. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. You dig into the broadband situation here in Wisconsin here, specifically during this pandemic, and you talked with some Wisconsinites about how they're managing. Introduce us to Tracy. How is she getting access to the internet?
Sure. So she has to drive. They live outside of Monroe, and she has, this is pretty common for a lot of people in rural areas. She has to drive to a parking lot, which is her employer, Blackhawk, Technical College, and she sits in the parking lot and has her laptop and uses the Wi-Fi there.
And, you know, that creates all kinds of hardship. I mean, you're far away from facilities, and also it's a small space. And you profile her, and also in the seat next to her is her teenage daughter.
Yeah, so they have a couple kids, and so now with the pandemic, they all have to work from home, and the internet's so poor that they have to switch off One at a time, doing homework and her work. So I think it's pretty common for a lot of rural people in Wisconsin.
Yeah, within a few weeks of time, schooling and work has really switched to being at home. We know 28% of Wisconsin's rural residents lack access to internet service from at least one provider. 43% of rural residents lack high-speed internet. Peter, how does this affect the new normal then of homeschooling via the internet?
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin is behind the national average in terms of rural broadband coverage. And so, I mean, I'm an urban dweller, so I can only I take it for granted my internet's good, but I don't know how you can do it if you're at home and struggling to get good internet. Good luck to the people that are trying to do it. I mean, I think they have to go sit in the library parking lot.
Right. And certainly we've been talking about students and trying to submit their homework or watch the videos, things that their teachers have posted. But we also have a lot of teachers who are trying to, you know, get that information to the students first, and they use the internet for that. So is this a problem for education maybe in a larger way than we might realize based on the people you've talked to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem. It's a problem everywhere. It's I mean, it's for, I mean, you think of everything you do on the computer. I'm trying to think what I don't do in my own life. And then if I had poor internet, I don't know how it would get around, especially now that everything's closed. Good luck to these people trying to get it done.
Well, what's the problem here? What did you find about the reasons that it's difficult to get broadband infrastructure to rural parts of Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to what it always comes down to is money and investment. So Wisconsin has, the state government has only put in about, in the last, from 2013 to 2019, about $20 million. Comparatively, if we look at our neighboring state, Minnesota, they have much better rural broadband coverage, and they've put in about five times the amount. They've spent about $100 million to grant internet service providers to put in fiber and put in various internet infrastructure. And the reason it's harder, one reason there's less internet coverage in rural areas is because it's expensive to bury the fiber optic cable. And if you're in an urban area or a suburban area where you have lots of homes, lots of customers, internet service providers and private for-profit companies are happy to make that investment because they, for every couple feet they put in the ground, they have multiple customers. But if you're in a rural area, there might be three houses in a mile. And so you bury a mile of fiber optic cable there, it's much, you're getting much less return on your investment. So that's why a lot of people advocate for the state government stepping in and helping to pay for some of that cost that might not be very profitable for private companies.
Peter Cameron is an investigative journalist who's been looking into Wisconsin's broadband access issue, and we're taking your calls this conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have access to a reliable internet connection? What issues do you run into? Do you think we should treat broadband like a public utility? What do you think the government's role should be? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there. Or you can email your question or your experience to us at ideas@wpr.org. Peter, you talked to a few lawmakers for your story. What's their take on what's happening with broadband in our state?
Well, personally, I mean, I spoke to State Senator Jeff Smith, who's out of Eau Claire, but he lives outside of the city, so he's on a farm outside, and his internet's very poor. He says he can't stream anything, and I think of the horror of not being able to watch Netflix. That's right. That's a big part of my life these days, and I think for a lot of people. But I mean, he introduced some bills in this most recent legislative session that, I mean, he's in the minority, so the Republican majority. They kind of died on the floor. There wasn't much movement on his bills. But some of the things he wanted to do, one idea is a dig once law that the federal government has tried to make it happen, but it hasn't yet. Where anytime there's any sort of excavation, any sort of digging for roads or plumbing, whatever, that you also need to lay fiber optic cable, and that can save a lot of money because the digging is a big part of the expense. Another thing he had was if you're laying a fiber optic cable, every house or business within 300 feet needs that. That could be a law that every residence would need to be connected in within a 300 foot. Distance. And so those are some ideas he had, but yeah, it's very frustrating. I mean, it's not surprising to any rural listeners, but it's very frustrating to have, sometimes there'll be a not fiber optic cable running right by your house, but they can't get the company to hook it up. So.
And there are ways to get internet access without the broadband infrastructure we're talking about. What did you learn from folks who use satellite or wireless technology for the internet?
Yeah, that's nice in that it doesn't require the sort of the expensive fiber optic plant to use it. But I mean, it can be affected by weather. It can be affected by trees and topography. And I was speaking with people in the Driftless area, and with all the hills and things, it can make reception really tough. So, I mean, fiber optic is, it's an expensive installation, but it's the most reliable internet because it doesn't really, it's not affected by those things.
Steve from Shell Lake has a story. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What are you thinking about as we have this conversation about internet access in rural areas?
Well, I know that CenturyLink is the main provider in our area for phone service. And I know they've gotten broadband grants to put fiber optic in the ground, and they have. Unfortunately, the grant did not require them to hook people up. And I think they've done very little marketing in trying to hook people up to their fiber optic network. And so if you're in rural areas, and, you know, I could consider Washburn County totally rural. We really have no urban. But at least in Spooner and Shell Lake, and I believe Minot and Trigo, Spectrum is there, and I have Spectrum Internet, and I have very adequate Internet service. But if you're 3 miles out of town, your internet probably doesn't exist unless you go wireless, and that can be iffy based on topography.
Yeah. So, Steve, thank you for catching us up on what's happening in your area. And Peter, that sounds like a great example of what you're talking about, where things can be really good in some areas, and then not far away, you find people who just don't have access, or it's really terrible and kind of too slow to even make it work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've talked to people that are in a farm in a rural area, and they just got lucky, and they happen to be right on a line, and they have incredibly fast internet. But I think the system's pretty patchy at this point as we try to get caught up. I mean, the federal government is granting tons of money for rural broadband expansion, but it's moving slowly, and it takes time. There's the FCC just announced a $20 billion national program, but I mean, that money, that the projects and the money will get dispersed in the next 10 years. So you're looking at, I don't know, you know, 2030 before some of these projects are done. So what we're getting there, but it's incredibly frustrating, I'm sure, for people that have, you know, glacial speeds.
Right. Yeah. And especially now when we're saying stay in your home as much as possible, and we still want you to do this work or this schoolwork, use the internet.
Yeah, they might have to drive to parking lots if you can find something that's open.
Right. Peter Cameron is an investigative journalist, and we're talking about how a lack of broadband internet access is affecting people in Wisconsin, especially in this pandemic. Peter has written a piece called Everyone Has to Have It, Broadband Gap Leaves Rural Wisconsin Behind During Coronavirus Crisis. And we're taking your calls, your perspectives on how the internet works or doesn't work for you in Wisconsin and how you think that could change. 800-642-1234. Can you handle, or can your internet connection handle increased use, working from home, doing school from home? Are you trying to connect with a healthcare provider online? Is that working, or is your connection getting in the way? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. As people work from home and kids learn from home and people video chat with health providers from home, we're using the internet as if it's a public utility, like water or electricity. It's an expectation that we have online access. But that's not true for everyone in Wisconsin. And our guest is writing about the barriers to internet access in our state. And we want to hear from you. Has your internet provider lowered costs or lifted restrictions in the last few weeks because of the coronavirus outbreak? What questions do you have about how other towns and states have gotten internet to the majority of their residents? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Investigative journalist Peter Cameron has written a piece about the challenges of lacking reliable access to the internet here in Wisconsin. And Cindy from Madison is ready to talk with us. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning. I am a teacher in a public school teacher here in Madison, and I teach technology at middle school. And one of my concerns over the years has been access. And right now, as we are planning in Madison for our next week going online with our virtual teaching, I want to be sure all of my students have access, and I don't know how to do that. And it's not acceptable for people to be saying, oh, our district will handle it. We, the teachers, need to know how to check with our students and find out if they have the access, because it's much more effective if you delegate and let the people on the front line who are connecting and building relationships with those kids to find out what their status is. I have a lot of anger in my voice because this is a topic that bothers me in the state of Wisconsin. I don't understand why we have to call the tech companies and ask them to increase our access. They should be doing that. It's unconscionable that we are having to call, wait online, and find out if they can increase our stupid internet access. They know they need to be doing it.
Cindy, thank you for that perspective. I want to give Peter a chance to respond, though, because Cindy is pointing out that even though she's in Madison, she still cannot guarantee that her students either have access because of where they live or also like might even be able to afford it in their homes. So there is a lot of inequity in Wisconsin's internet access here, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, that makes me think of the city of Madison in the last couple years, in 2018, they did a study and looked at what it would cost to, I mean, even the city of Madison doesn't have high-speed internet everywhere, and they wanted to look at what it would cost the city to implement that everywhere. And the report told them it would cost about $175 million. And so that's a huge amount of money. And I think a lot of this comes down to spending and do we want to spend that kind of money eventually we're going to have to, but how fast is it going to happen? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. Sarah in Columbus is ready to join the conversation now, too. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. Well, mine piggybacks quite nicely on your previous caller. I'm a teacher in Columbus. We're a very rural district, even though we are so close to Madison. So I've got students who, you know, have internet access at home, and they've got the good stuff because they're in town, but then there's people like me, we're 3/4 mile off being able to get the high-speed internet. And then we've got all these smaller towers in the area that will allow you to be connected to the net. But my neighbors have trees, so I can't get that either, which really left me in a hard spot going, oh, I've got 6 gigs of data for the rest of the month. I'm a teacher, and I have 2 kids at home. How is this going to work for us? And the district stepped up, and the district came up with a solution for those of us. And, you know, so I've got my internet now. But now I'm also helping my students. This is our first week of online learning, and the family's trying to figure out, okay, how do we do this without putting 5 kids in a car and driving into town to sit in the parking lot at the elementary school? So it becomes more, for me, a systemic question and a societal question of how are we going to look at this as more of a human right and a safety issue even now. And what are we going to do moving forward? Because we're trying to find Band-Aids now, but what are we doing for the future?
Yeah, Sarah, thank you for giving us that perspective. And Peter Cameron, Wisconsin investigative journalist who is writing about broadband expansion challenges in our state. Sarah mentions, trying to figure out how much bandwidth she has left, how much internet she can use for the rest of the month. And also this idea that we are treating the internet as if it's a public utility, like everybody should have access. But that's not how we regulate it, right?
It's not a public utility. Whereas it would, rate hikes would have to be approved by the government. So no, it's not. One thought I had on people complaining about their local internet service provider not providing very good service. Competition can really change that. I know my parents' home in Wanakee. I think they had Charter, and then another company came in, and they both started. They were really aggressive in raising speeds and cutting costs, and in some areas where there is no competition, where there's only one internet service provider, there have been areas where the municipality, the city, might step in and build their own infrastructure and just offer some competition to force that other provider to step their game up, kind of like the public option in health insurance.
Which you've actually found in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, the city of Reedsburg, in that case, the utility actually provides service. They have cable guys that go out and hook you up. And they have really fast internet, and it's actually pretty cheap, too, but it's about $45 a month for 1,000 megabits of download speed, which, if you know, that's a lot. But a lot of municipalities just don't want to take on – a lot of public utilities don't want to take on that additional – I mean, the investment in planting the fiber optic cable, but also you have to have customer service people, and it's a big undertaking that a lot of cities and towns don't want to do.
Let's also bring Jim from Menominee into the conversation. Jim, welcome to the morning show.
Hi, good morning. So I'm just north of Menominee, and we basically pay twice as much for costs for our satellite that we have than what you would pay for normal high-speed cable internet down in the city. And we also, with that, we get data caps that we routinely hit at least halfway to three-quarters of the month in, and that's just on, like, the basic cheapest plan that's already double. So for the most part, the service hasn't been bad or anything. It's just we just routinely hit these data caps that don't exist to anyone else out there.
Interesting. Jim, thanks for the perspective then, because you aren't able to get the broadband. And Peter, we know that technology advances quickly, and so we're not even caught up to getting everybody access. And yet the speeds required, what we need to get to people and what they need to work is kind of a moving target. How are state government and internet providers trying to catch up?
So the state of Wisconsin does not require a speed limit or when it gives grants to internet service providers, if that makes sense. So the state of Minnesota, when they give grants to internet service providers, you have to provide the federal definition of broadband, which is 25 megabits per second download speed. In Wisconsin, we don't do that. Now they take that into account when awarding grants, but that's something that we could be doing. The state of Minnesota also has a future target to gradually increase speeds and the mandatory minimums. In Wisconsin, we don't do that, and that's something that could help because, yeah, as you say, the technology continues to improve. And I mean, I've got a 4K TV, and if you have multiple kids watching streaming, it's going to eat up your internet speeds pretty fast. So yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that we need to think about is increasing the speed, not just getting everybody at a basic level, but continuing to increase.
Yeah, certainly a multifaceted challenge when it comes to broadband expansion here in Wisconsin, huh?
Exactly.
All right. Peter, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for letting us talk about your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Cameron is an investigative journalist and also the managing editor of the Badger Project. That's a nonpartisan journalism nonprofit which covers Wisconsin state government and politics. And we've been talking about broadband access and expansion here in Wisconsin. We've got a link to the piece that he wrote up on the Wisconsin Watch website. It's at ours. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, back-to-back conversations with the candidates for Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.